050951, in re Southwestern Bell Telephone Company, LP.
May I please report, Mr. Watson will present an argument for the delay of the later, and has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is not just another mandamus from a South Texas district court. This one is actually a suit for money damages for phone bill charges approved by rule, contested hearing to set what the charge would be, tariff, and finally placed in the charge by the Public Utility Commission. We did what the commission told us to do. It is not a complex case. It can be solved by addressing three issues, but those issues are extremely important, both to the effective administration of justice in this state and to companies such as Southwest Bell facing massive company-breaking class action suits, which this also happens to be. Those three issues, quickly, are: one, we all know the PUC has exclusive original jurisdiction over everything, business and property of a utility. You've said that. You've also said, however, that the PUC has exclusive jurisdiction to provide a remedy. That is something new. You said that in Entergy. That must be repeated so the point is made that there is no common law cause of action such as there was in Subaru and Butenara under an entirely different jurisdictional scheme. Second, the Universal Service Fund and Universal Service is the reason the Public Utility Commission exists. It is the first policy statement in PURA. And it is given exclusive original jurisdiction to affect universal service at reasonable rates to all Texas residents. The second issue is, was that sacrifice, was its jurisdiction sacrificed on the altar of a handful of incentive regulation basic charges? You laid the groundwork for answering that no in AT&T versus Southwest Bell. It simply needs to be extended to say the obvious, that the commission has jurisdiction to say a rate cap agreement between us and the commission either has or has not been busted. If not the commission, who else? Certainly not the District Court of Hidalgo County. Third, because this is a class action, because so much is at stake, because it affects every telephone company in this state and the very guts of what the PUC is supposed to do, this court's analysis that it began back in CSR versus Link, brought forward in AIU Insurance, in DuPont, and finally Prudential, of saying that when we look if whether there's an adequate remedy on appeal, obviously we always have one when there's interference with jurisdiction. That's a given. You always mandamus that. But here also, we really could use the court addressing not just mass torts in the past, but whether class actions themselves impose such a severe hardship that they threaten ever reaching appellate review. And that's particularly true in this case, where the class action itself was brought 2 months and 4 days before the effective date of House Bill 4, which means House Bill 4 and the possibility of an interlocutory appeal do not apply to us. And plaintiffs' counsels will not be paid in coupons as a result. This is for real money. And as a result of that, the stakes are enormous. First, exclusive jurisdiction. There's no question that 52002 gives exclusive original jurisdiction over the entire business and property of the telecommunications industry. The grant is even broader than the grant that was given to the electric utilities in Entergy. Indeed, it reaches directly back and says it's to implement the policy in 52001, which is universal service. That's the reason it was created. Second, and this is the real issue here, does that grant of exclusive jurisdiction extend, as you said it did in Entergy, to applying an exclusively administrative remedy for an administrative wrong? The plaintiffs say under Subaru and Buchnera, they have a right to run back to district court for common law causes of action. They are wrong. And that distinction needs to be made, and it is a common mistake.
The PUC is a little vague on what the remedy would be in this case. What's your view of if there have been overcharges on interstate revenues or some other aspect of this was done improperly, what do you think the commission can do about it?
First, I think that they can do anything necessary to effect an effective remedy. That's what this court said unanimously in Entergy. But I have an example. One of the claims that was outstanding when the motion to dismiss for want of jurisdiction was denied, one of the claims that had not yet been made, was a claim that the PUC was wrong when it imposed state TUSF charges on interstate carriers who are already paying federal universal service charges. In other words, the Fifth Circuit held in a complaint by AT&T, not seeking damages, just saying we shouldn't have to pay two universal service charges on interstate rates. And it said that's right. To that extent, state is preempted, and you shouldn't have to pay state universal charges, service charges on top of federal. What did the PUC do about it? Well, they came right back and initiated docket 29950 and sent out word to all interested parties to answer these questions. Does the court decision require a refund of TUSF assessments on telecommunications providers attributable to interstate and international telecommunications received? If they're made to the providers, should they be required to refund the amounts to their customers? How do we true up the shortfall since the fund runs on a cash-in, cash-out basis? The surcharges go in, and they are immediately distributed. So there's a very thin capitalization. And even should the companies be allowed to go back and surcharge the true-up? The PUC is on top of it from soup to nuts. Docket 29950 is still wide open. Plaintiffs can walk down and file their claim in 29950 today. Instead, they're in Hidalgo County and are attempting to stay in Hidalgo County.
But I do suppose the commission looks on their role as remedial rather than punitive, which you would have with the DTPA or fraud or some other sort of common law action.
And the question before this court is exactly that.
But I mean, you think that's true, that the PUC looks at it as their role of remedial?
PUC would look at their role as, well, let me just put it in this court's words, because of the adjudicatory section that's in the PUC that's not in every other jurisdictional statute and which did not exist in Subaru and Buchnera, where the statute actually said you have permission to go to district court and file a DTPA claim or a breach of the duty of good faith claim, or a breach of contract claim. The statute gave that authority. Here it's just the opposite. When the statute at section 14.051 et sec brought in the ability for the commission to kick everything to SOA and have the independent judges of the utility division of SOA come in and decide these claims, It did so on the basis that the statutes, meaning 14.05, it said, also placed in the commission a power to decide as a regulatory matter and to award an administrative remedy to rectify any administrative wrong and any resulting administrative consequences. The point is, administrative wrongs and administrative consequences will be trued up by the commission. That doesn't mean you're going to get mental anguish damages. It doesn't mean you're going to get perhaps even attorney's fees, certainly not class attorney's fees. But the wrong will be righted. That's what you said in Energy. We desperately need you to clarify it in this case that it means what it said. Now, moving on. Why, with this remarkably broad grant of jurisdiction, be thrown out? The plaintiffs say that it was sacrificed on the altar of incentive regulation. There's an easy way and a hard way to do this. The easy way is to look at the purpose of the statute and see what was being done. And you only need to look at three things. First, we know that Quinn incentive regulation for a handful of rates, one of which was access charges, which did have universal service funding in it by padding access charges. That's the old way of doing it. You said that in AT&T Southwest Bell, you were right. When it brought in incentive regulation of that and a handful of other charges, it pulled in this implicit funding for universal service out of the access charge, took it over, gave it its own chapter, Chapter 56, Subpart B. And in Chapter 56, Subpart B, it said, let's get the priorities straight. Not only between universal service charges and rates, or rate incentive rate regulation, but against everything else in PURA. And what they said was in 56002, if this chapter conflicts with any other provision of this title, PURA, this chapter prevails. Then what did they do? Third, finally, in Chapter 58, the incentive regulation statute, they went in Chapter 58 and said, this chapter does not affect a charge permitted under Subchapter B of Chapter 56. Subchapter B of Chapter 56 is universal service. I don't know how they could have made it any clearer. They removed it from rates and gave it its own chapter. They said, whatever you do in that chapter doesn't affect the cap under Chapter 58. And they said everything about Chapter 56 must dominate over everything else contrary in this code. This is not a rate. This is a separate animal made into an explicit charge with absolute authority to make that charge. It was brought through by a specific rule by the commission. That commission had a comment period. Plaintiffs didn't appear. The amount was set in a contested case. Plaintiffs didn't appear. It was added in an amended tariff that was a contested case. Plaintiffs didn't appear. When part of it was wrong, and the commission on its own motion set in process a refund function, or a refund action, 29950. Plaintiffs didn't appear. The only question in this case is, does the District Court of Hidalgo County and every other district court in this case have jurisdiction to decide for itself what phone charges are valid, and in doing so, what statutes are valid, and what rules and actions and orders of the commission are valid? That cannot be. It must be within the exclusive jurisdiction of the Public Utility Commission. And when you add on top of that the Damocles sword of class action with threats to sue corporate officers, you bring into play the third item, and that is even if this were under tort reform and under the new statute, you should come in, and even if there were conflicting, interfering jurisdiction, you should come in and say the hardship is so great because you're going to be pounded into submission in this case and not ever reach appeal, that we've got to intervene and stop it.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party.
May it please the court. Mr. Gurria will present argument from the real party.
May it please the court. Southwestern Bell has a heavy burden in this mandamus proceeding. They have two things that they have to show. They have to show that the trial court clearly abused its discretion and that they don't have an adequate remedy by appeal. I want to start with the second prong first because I believe that the Civil Practice and Remedy Code does apply to this case. In 26.051, the Texas legislature granted Southwestern Bell an interlocutory appeal in a class action from the denial of a plea to the jurisdiction. The only caveat is that Southwestern Bell has to wait until a class is certified in order to take that appeal. Because the legislature has provided Southwestern Bell with an adequate remedy by appeal, they cannot meet the second prong necessary for mandamus. Counsel, for the first time today, addressed that particular argument. He indicated that House Bill 4 does not apply to this case. Even if it doesn't, under this court's ruling in Bell Helicopter from 1990, it is previously said that mandamus is not available for the denial of a plea to the jurisdiction. A party can apply for an appeal, and since House Bill 4 provided for a direct appeal of a class certification order to this court, Southwestern Bell would be able to raise their jurisdictional argument at that time.
You don't think our mandamus standards have changed somewhat since AIU Prudential?
The NRA Prudential case that the court issued in 2004, is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
I believe that the court reaffirmed the fact that mandamus would be available if specific things are shown. However, in this case, because Southwestern Bell specifically is granted the ability to raise these arguments as a result or as a part of a class certification order directly to this court, then an extraordinary writ like a mandamus should not be available. That would allow for two interruptions in the litigation to this court when really, to save time and the party's resources, there should be only one. In other words,
the argument is made that this is a little different because it affects the telecommunications industry throughout the state, and the allocation of jurisdiction to the PUC. What's your response to that?
First of all, I want to reassure this court that universal service in the state of Texas is not in danger. Under the statutes 56.021 and 56.022, Southwestern Bell and the other telecommunications companies are required to pay money into the Universal Service Fund. Whether or not they subsequently recover that money from their customers in the form of a surcharge is a completely separate issue. As for whether or not it would affect the other telecommunications companies in the state, our allegations is that the addition of the surcharge to rate cap basic services is what causes the particular violation of law in this case.
But your argument is that they shouldn't be allowed to do it even though the commission has said they can't.
There are a number of problems with the commission's order. First of all, the legislature was not silent on this subject. The legislature has specifically, in 56.107, allowed for a universal service surcharge. They've also allowed for a universal service surcharge in 56.155. What they say is that you add those two together. Because the legislature had an opportunity to provide for a universal surcharge and they determined that they were only going to allow a limited surcharge. The PUC was without jurisdiction to go and allow the companies to surcharge the amounts for the all 9 or 10 of the universal service programs. The legislature had an opportunity to address the subject. They did address the subject. They allowed limited surcharges. And the PUC as a subordinate body was without jurisdiction to go and change or alter what the legislature had determined.
But it seems to me that even if that argument were correct, assuming that what you say is true, that the most that could happen would be that there'd be a declaratory judgment or some adjudication that the commission acted outside the scope of its power. But you'd be still back at the commission worrying about how this surcharge gets imposed and paid.
There's another issue related to the PUC's order. It's our contention that the rule itself was void ab initio. The reason for that is under 53.001B, the legislature indicated that a rule of the PUC may not conflict with a rule of a federal regulatory body, the FCC in this case. It's our contention that in the FCC's 1997 Universal Service Order, it indicated that it had jurisdiction to determine whether or not universal service surcharges would be allowed to be collected by ILECs like Southwestern Bell. At that time, the FCC determined that it was going to withhold that jurisdiction and that ILECs would be required to recover their universal service contributions from access charges, which had been traditionally the method by which universal service in the state had been funded. Because of that, the PUC was without jurisdiction in 1998 to adopt its order indicating that the companies could surcharge their customers on their service, including basic services.
But even so, why isn't that something that the commission has to rectify as opposed to the basis of a claim for damages?
The problem is that Southwestern Bell is collecting the rates. As such, they are existing rates. And under the statutory scheme, the PUC no longer has jurisdiction to determine whether or not existing rates of an electing company violate the law or unreasonable. That's 53.151C. That statute traditionally had given the PUC the authority to determine whether or not rates were unlawful or unreasonable upon complaint by an affected party or on its own motion. However, when the legislature enacted incentive regulation, the purpose of which was to take rates from the PUC's jurisdiction, it implemented Section C to 53.151, which is specifically exempt Chapter 58 companies from that jurisdiction by the company, or by the PUC.
As to rates.
Furthermore, if you look at 52.001, which grants the PUC exclusive jurisdiction over the rates of telephone companies in this state, that grant of jurisdiction says it is subject to limitations. As this court has recognized in the AT&T versus Southwestern Bell case and in the Cities of Austin case, the PUC no longer has jurisdiction over Southwestern Bell's rates.
So does your argument turn on whether this is a rate, this universal service charge?
That is a very important part of the argument, the question of whether or not it is a rate.
If it isn't, is that the end of it?
That might well be the case. However, we know that the legislature has defined what rates are in 11.003, Section 16. A rate is any compensation, tariff, charge, or other classification that is directly or indirectly demanded by a public utility for a service. By collecting the surcharge as a percentage of the cost for basic services, it is our contention that a universal service surcharge is, in fact, a rate.
It seems like it could be a rate, because it was once embedded in the access charge. But has the legislature changed that by separating out Chapter 56?
I don't believe the fact that the charge appears as a separate charge on the telephone bill has any effect. We know that a universal service surcharge increases the cost for basic service. We know that because the FCC said so in its universal service order in paragraph 827. We also know that surcharges increase the cost of basic services because the Third Court of Appeals in two cases, including one involving Southwestern Bell in 1993 and then another case in 1998, indicated that the addition of statutory surcharges to basic services results in an increase in the cost of those basic services in violation of the rate cap. Finally, the Supreme Court itself has a line of cases which indicates that if a company attempts to recover contributions for which they are liable for under state law, then that adds to the price of the service. Therefore, I don't believe there really is an issue as to whether or not the universal service surcharges increases the cost of basic services in violation of Southwestern Bell's rate cap.
Even if that were true, even if it were part of the rate, how do you square Entergy where we said it's up to the commission to fashion a remedy for any sort of violation? How do you get away from that language?
The first thing out of counsel's mouth this morning was that this was a class action for money damages. On the PUC's own complaint form, which we've attached, they indicate that they don't have authority to provide money damages. That's what they would have to do, and they themselves are saying they can't do it. Furthermore, even more of a reason, the PUC was the one that let them do this in the first place, acting in a quasi-legislative fashion.
But doesn't that sort of beg the question? I mean, if there is exclusive jurisdiction here, that kind of means the PUC has to fashion the remedy. And even though they can't regulate the rate under incentive regulation, they can fashion a remedy that would rectify the wrong, albeit an administrative remedy.
Well, it's our contention that as far as the recovery of the surcharges is concerned, that was not something that the legislature left to the PUC. As such, that would not be a part of their exclusive jurisdiction. The legislature themselves identified the limited surcharges that they wanted the telephone companies to recover. Specifically, as far as Southwestern Bell is concerned, the legislature had a specific scheme in mind to allow them to continue to recover their universal service contributions from their access charges. As this court found in AT&T versus Southwestern Bell, the PUC had no jurisdiction to lower Southwestern Bell's access charges below 6 cents a minute, even though the actual cost was only 1 cent. As part of the 1999 statutes that the legislature enacted, they heard testimony that for every penny of access charges that Southwestern Bell was receiving, that was the equivalent of $93 million. At that same time, a bill, House Bill 1701, had been proposed that would have allowed Southwestern Bell to do exactly what they're claiming they're allowed to do anyway. That part of that bill would have allowed them to recover the entire amount of their universal service contributions. There was also a further section in that proposed bill that specifically said that an electing company would be allowed to recover that surcharge on rate cap basic services, which is the very issue in this case. The legislature did not pass that bill. We submit to the court that that was evidence of the legislature's intent to deny Southwestern Bell and any other electing companies the ability to increase the cost of basic services through the addition of universal service surcharges.
We don't usually infer from a bill's failure to pass that the legislature meant anything, since it's hard enough to tell what they meant when it does pass. Why should we do it here?
I think there's other evidence of the legislature's intent. Again, if you look at 56021 and 022, that sets out the general rule. The general rule is that the companies are required to fund or contribute to universal service. By allowing the companies to then turn around and recover the entire amount of their universal surcharge from their customers, we submit to the court that the legislature's intent has been thwarted because the customers are now funding universal service and not the companies. Furthermore, we go to the fact that the legislature had an opportunity to allow the companies to recover the entire amount of their surcharge in 56107 and 56155, and they specifically rejected that. So if you combine that with the fact that an attempt was then made to allow them to recover their entire amount and the legislature rejected that, I think that's consistent with what the legislature had been saying all along.
Now, there's some reference in our notes, or in my notes, that this scheme was modeled after some Illinois scheme. What impact, if any, does that have on legislative intent?
Although this is a case of first impression here in the state of Texas, other states have enacted similar statutory schemes to the incentive regulation, which was enacted here. Furthermore, the Texas scheme was actually based upon the Illinois scheme, which had been enacted earlier. This very issue of whether or not the PUC or the State Commission has continuing authority to allow refunds to an electing company was considered by an Illinois Court of Appeals, and they, similar to the trial court and the Court of Appeals in this case, denied that motion. They denied a motion to dismiss based on the fact that under the new statutory scheme, the commission no longer had exclusive jurisdiction to determine whether or not an electing company was subject to a refund claim.
Now, is that contrary to what this court said in the Entergy case about exclusive jurisdiction for that utility?
I think the court's decision in Entergy is distinguishable based on the fact that, one, it involved a completely different statutory scheme with regards to electric utilities. The scheme with regarding electric utilities, as this court's opinion pointed out, indicated that it was a comprehensive scheme designed to allow the PUC to regulate electrical utilities. However, in the statutes regarding or regulating the telephone companies, we know that the legislature has set forth specific statutes in addition to 53.151. We know that the legislature in 58.025 has specifically pointed out that under no circumstances can the commission hear a complaint, make a determination, or conduct a hearing regarding the reasonableness of an electing company's rates. Therefore, based on that particular scheme, it is expressly depriving the PUC of exclusive jurisdiction to decide or hear a refund claim.
What did the Illinois Supreme Court do in that case that you talked about?
That particular case was not appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court, and to my knowledge, no other state appellate courts have issued any type of published opinion regarding this. So as far as, you know, some assistance in trying to come up with this court's ruling, all we have is the Wernikoff opinion from Illinois.
So Illinois could point to the 13th Court's ruling in this case as support for their case.
The opinion issued by the 13th Court of Appeals was just a per curiam opinion. It didn't really discuss the issues in the case. I believe the Wernikoff case sets forth both the statutes, and if you compare those statutes in Illinois to the statutes that we've cited and relied upon here in Texas, the court can see that the language in those two statutes is almost identical. And we would submit to the court that, that there's no reason to construe similar statutory language in a different manner.
Now, whether it's a rate or not is a critical issue in this particular case. You filed the case in Hidalgo County. It could have been filed in Randall County or even in Travis County. And you might get different results. Courts in those various places. Could you?
That was one of the reasons why we made the decision to file it as a class action. We were aware that eventually it was going to come to this court as the court of last resort for civil matters in this state to construe these statutes and ultimately determine what they mean. In terms of whether or not this actually is a rate, we believe that that is a question of law. We believe that questions of law is a further exception to the exclusive jurisdiction doctrine. We believe that a district court empowered by the Texas Constitution to hear claims will be able to construe the statutes, which, you know, as far as we're concerned, would be a relatively simple matter to determine whether or not these surcharges is actually a rate and ultimately make a uniform decision that this court would hear. Furthermore, because of the fact that this court now hears direct appeals of class certification orders, there wouldn't be any issue as to whether or not there would be a type of uniform order issued. This court would be able to make a binding determination at that time, because I'm sure Southwestern Bell, if they choose to or chose to, will be able to continue to press their jurisdictional challenge at that time. One of the other issues that I briefly wanted to address was this question regarding the collection of the TUSF surcharges on interstate services. We know that the Fifth Circuit has already determined that that was unlawful. The question becomes, how do the customers get this money back that a court of law has determined was unlawful? When the Fifth Circuit issued their opinion in 2004, we amended our petition to add that claim to this class action lawsuit because we felt like it was consistent with the other claims or refund claims that were already in the case. As part of this mandamus proceeding, Southwestern Bell included that in this appeal, although the trial court had not at that time heard a plea to the jurisdiction on that particular claim. It's our contention that because the trial court had not had an opportunity to rule on a plea to the jurisdiction, that this court would be without mandamus jurisdiction to issue a ruling regarding that matter, because the trial court had not abused its discretion because no ruling had been made.
Why can't the PUC grant that kind of relief, as they've indicated in the other, in the pending docket, 29950?
The reason for that is because if the PUC is the entity that allowed the company to recover the charge in the first place, the PUC cannot then turn around and act in a quasi-judicial role and say, well, you know what? We made a mistake. We shouldn't have allowed you to collect that charge. They cannot retroactively change the rates by allowing a refund claim because that would be a due process violation. The Supreme Court said that in the Arizona grocery case, that if a state commission acting in a quasi-legislative role allows a company to collect a rate based on its determination that that rate is just and reasonable, they cannot then, acting in a quasi-judicial role, turn around and say that that was a mistake for the purposes of allowing a refund claim.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Please, the court. Let's go through a few things quickly. First, whether there's an adequate remedy on appeal because of 26001. Let's be very clear.
051?
Yeah. This case was filed on June 27, 2003. The historical notes to Section 26 make it crystal clear that it applies only to cases filed after September 1, 2003. That is not available. This court has already held essentially the same thing in Long versus Thomas in one of the early tort reform cases coming up. Document A in the verified record is the original petition, file stamp June 27, 2003. Historical notes say that doesn't count. But even if it did, interlocutory appeal isn't enough when it's a class action causing this kind of damage. That's why we asked for the instruction to go, the direction that this court could give to go beyond this case and show that it is not going to be tolerated giving void orders, doing void discovery, suing company officials, trying to bludgeon down a DuPont-type settlement when, in fact, that's wrong and is going to ultimately deny us any type of an effective right on appeal. You cited in DuPont the blood case out of the Seventh Circuit that Judge Posner wrote, where he talked about the problem of class action, and he quoted Judge Friendly, it's not my words, a class action blackmail, where there is so much on the line when void orders are being entered, the company can't recover. Now, you've started getting into it in AIU, DuPont, CSR, in mass torts. It's respectfully, badly needed in the area of class actions.
Differences about an interlocutory appeal that make it inadequate? How's it different from a mandamus?
Because the plaintiff controls when the interlocutory appeal is heard by controlling when the class certification occurs. We still haven't had one. It can go on forever. It is not adequate. Second, they're saying that the rule itself is void ab initio. Well, if that's the case, they need to be in Travis County District Court under 38.001 saying just that, not in Hidalgo County. But what they're saying, the FCC declaring it void ab initio, is just flat wrong. Judge Jerry Smith of the Fifth Circuit in Office of Public Utility Council versus the FCC held that provision of the FCC order saying that the states must charge via switch access charges being raised up, that that's the way they must pass it through, is unlawful. It was voided. 2 or 3 months later, the joint council between the states and the federals trying to reconcile these things met and said, thus the statutory scheme demonstrates that the states are encouraged to become partners with the commission in ensuring sufficient support mechanisms, and the states may prescribe additional supplemental mechanisms. Incumbent LEC's options for recovering their universal service contributions were expanded to include end-user charges. That is a non-issue. We would refer you to our letter reply of July 26, 2006, where that is nailed. Next, they're saying that, in fact, only two provisions were authorized and that that excludes the others. But again, in their reply to the amicus briefs, they give the reason for the two statutes authorizing charges, and that was the federal law came in and said, we don't care if you do pass through surcharges on these others, you've got to surcharge these two. So we complied, consistent with trying to be consistent with federal law. That doesn't mean the others weren't authorized. It does mean these were. In the end, who decides this case is either the Travis County District Court or it's the Public Utility Commission under Energy. It is not Hidalgo County.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. If there are no further questions, the pause is submitted, and that concludes argument.